From Johannesburg to Jerusalem, the world is always changing, growing and innovating. Join Benji Shulman for the next hour as he brings you the trendsetters, the thought leaders and those creating news before it happens. Only on the New Blue Review, your favorite Jewish culture and current affairs show. Every Monday at 9 a.m. right here on 101.9 High FM.
You're listening to 101.9 High FM. I'm Benji Shulman. This is the New Blue Review. Welcome to the show on this Monday morning. Hope you are having a good one out there. I know it has been a little bit wet, but we need the rain. So I hope that you manage to figure it all out. And I can promise you now we have a fantastic show coming up as we always do. We'll be stopping in to look at Parliament a little bit later on. Looking at a few issues internationally. But to begin with, our first guest for this morning's show is David Ansara. He is the CEO of the Free Market Foundation, and we're going to be chatting to him about the state of the economy and the state of the government and international trade in general, because these are things that are crucial for our country. So the Free Market Foundation has been commenting quite a lot on some of the happenings that have been happening in our country. So it should be really, really interesting. Dave, thank you so much for joining us on High FM.
Thanks, Benji. It's great to be with you.
Yeah, really cool to have you on. Just for people who are not aware, the Free Market Foundation, when did it start? What does it do?
Well, I was born in 1983, but the Free Market Foundation was born in 1975. So I'm standing on the shoulders of giants, so to speak. And really, the Free Market Foundation began during a period in which I think it was widely recognized that the apartheid system was unsustainable, but it wasn't very clear what was going to replace it politically. And the Free Market Foundation played a very important role in advocating for free choice, individual liberty, free market economics, a free enterprise. And I think played a very historic role during that transitionary period as well, as apartheid ended into the 90s. So the rule of law, constitutionalism is a very important feature of a free society. And so the FMF advocated very strongly for the private property rights clause during the constitutional negotiations. Private property rights is still a very important cause of ours. And fast forward to today, we still fiercely advocating for the right of you as an individual to choose how you conduct your business, your right to protect your assets and your property. We think that people flourish when they're left to their own devices, where you have a small government that doesn't interfere in people's choices. And really, markets are the greatest drivers of prosperity that the world has ever seen. And we want more of that in South Africa. We have too much poverty, too much unemployment, and the solution to those problems is to embrace freedom. And that's what we're trying to persuade South Africans to do.
So obviously we're at a little bit of a strange junction then, given your sort of historical background, because we have this government of national unity. It's got people with quite wide and divergent viewpoints in some respects, on particularly on the economy, most perhaps importantly on the economy. In fact, maybe the economy is the most important divider in some respects of this GNU. And it's been around now plus days. What's been your viewpoint of where we are with this thing and what they should be doing more of?
So I think on the plus side, the events of May of this year really heralded a major shift in South Africa's politics. For the first time, we saw the ruling African National Congress, after 30 years in power, losing its majority. And I think that that was significant. The formation of the GNU, now we see a number of former opposition parties within the government with the potential to influence policy. And I emphasize that word potential, because I think whilst many people have welcomed with open arms the formation of the GNU, I think one of the concerns that we have is we haven't seen a significant shift in terms of policy. So there's a lot of new energy and clean new brooms sweeping clean, but we aren't really seeing these parties being able to differentiate themselves from the model of economic governance that has characterized the last, particularly the last 10 to 15 years, which has actually exacerbated a lot of the problems we were talking about earlier, very high unemployment, persistent poverty. So I think that there is an opportunity for some of these erstwhile opposition parties to try and influence the policy agenda. But to be frank, we haven't really seen the sense of urgency, the willingness to really confront the holy cows of policy in South Africa. If you think of the BEE framework, for example, nobody's really talking about that. NHI is still on the agenda. It was signed into law on the 15th of May by the president. That was arguably one of the decisive variables that led to that collapse in ANC support, because many aspirant middle-class people probably are quite worried about having private healthcare taken away from them. And I think NHI is a very good example because if you look at a party like the DA, they were vehemently opposed to NHI before the elections, threatening court action and so on. But now the language from them is a bit more cautious, say, well, look, we don't agree with this policy. We're going to explore backroom channels. And I think that that's an interesting phenomenon because whilst dialogue behind the scenes and persuasion is certainly important, ultimately, politics is around the contestation for power and the contestation of ideas. And you need to make the case to the public, and you need public support on your side to put pressure on your opponents. There's this idea of the balance of forces. So, and I think that that raises also very interesting prospects of who fills that void. If a well-established opposition party like the Democratic Alliance and others now find themselves behind the closed doors of cabinet, where does that leave us as members of the public? We are confronted with this black box that we don't know what's happening within the black box, and then suddenly policy decisions are made there that then spill out and affect our daily lives. So I think one of the things we have warned about is GNU euphoria, that civil society and other watchdog groups, the media, maybe there's a risk that they fall asleep because they have GNU euphoria and they think that now all of the problems are solved. But this is just step one out of 100 that need to be taken in order to fix some of the problems in our country.
Let's talk about the NHI then as one of those issues. Obviously, when you're talking about ideas and how to contest them, is that you've got to have a slightly different solution or completely different solution, different approach. So, given the NHI and the model there, which is that the government takes over all of healthcare, or not necessarily run it. My understanding of the NHI is that sort of the government will become the kind of buyer of healthcare and then distribute it to the populace, kind of, so to speak. And that's the model. And at the moment, we have a kind of dual model, which is, you can, there is a public healthcare system, or you can kind of opt out of it or opt both in by buying private healthcare. So what, given the kind of, horrific, quite frankly, healthcare outcomes that we have in our country, what would be the FMF's kind of viewpoint on what looks like an alternative with something like NHR?
Well, we would want far more choice for individuals. We definitely would not support a policy that limits and constrains choice. So I think many people observe the public healthcare system and they read stories about babies in a neonatal ward being kept in cardboard boxes on the floor in the Eastern Cape, and they're rightly horrified by stories like that. There's many billions of rands in the public healthcare sector that go towards medical malpractice claims, legal liability claims against the state for botched operations or other instances of neglect or mismanagement. So I think people are rightly worried about that those problems. But the solution to that is not to nationalize more features of healthcare in this country. We actually have a highly competitive, world-class private healthcare service, and for those who can afford it, I think that that is very important. But at the same time, it's important to improve access to particularly working class and aspirant middle class people who are currently often of their own volition paying out of pocket for those private services. So they're not actually within the normal medical aid schemes, but they want quality care. And the state has actually refused to amend legislation and regulations which would enable low-cost benefit options to flourish in South Africa, which I think is unconscionable, that for political reasons, in order to push for this very statist, centralized, nationalized kind of policy, NHI, they're willing to lock potentially millions of people out of the private system. And I think that's explicitly for political reasons, because they want to vilify the private system as some kind of elite, very exclusive system, where in actual fact, patients and also the private healthcare providers have a strong interest in extending this coverage. So, you know, I think we need to also look at some of the political drivers behind some of these things. There's a history of corruption and exploitation. You may be familiar with Babita Diakoran, who was assassinated. She was a whistleblower, and she lost her life because she was exposing corruption and malfeasance at Tembisa Hospital in Gauteng. So, you know, there is wide-scale looting and corruption. I think it's reasonable to assume that if the state had to extend its power through this NHI framework, that we would see much greater levels of these kinds of abuses of governance and management and so on. So, you know, I think we should resist something like NHI very wholeheartedly.
From kind of political perspective, which is what you were talking about earlier, that I think is one of the core issues that groups like yourself are up against when they're talking about trying to create a more market-friendly system. Because I think that the viewpoint inside people's heads, whether it's connected to reality or not, is a different story, but or at least the viewpoint that is promulgated by those who are opposed to more free market measures, is that you have this very unequal society, and that came about because of a system that was oppressive. And so what you need is some sort of equalization in the society so that people, you know, so that the system kind of doesn't back elites. And then if you just back the market, then you know, it's going to expand inequality and lock people out of services and raise prices. I mean, that's always tends to be the narrative that goes on. And it doesn't matter what the issue is. It can be healthcare, it can be electricity, minimum wage debate, BEE, all of these things. And I wonder how, you know, as people who are up against this kind of idea, like, how do you guys go about making the case that this is a better alternative?
Well, I think the conversation needs to be steered towards, if we really value the rights of all South Africans, we need to actually not be coercing them into making decisions against their will. We also have to understand that government is not the solution for everything. And even when you have a well-intentioned government, no amount of planning and orchestration by any bureaucrat, whether that's a civil servant in Denmark or Finland, or down here in sub-Saharan Africa, they all face the same constraints, that they have limited information. They have often incentives that don't necessarily align with the interests of the citizens that they ostensibly represent. They are operating on short-term electoral cycles. I mean, there's clearly, if you look at something like expropriation without compensation or NHI, these are political campaigns. This is not necessarily about restitution or justice. It's really about perpetuating political power. So I think we need to have a healthy skepticism of both the capacity of the state to do the things that it proclaims to do, and also its interests. You know, politics is really, as I mentioned earlier, about the contestation and accumulation and application of power. I think we have to be kind of realistic about how politicians behave. They have an interest in perpetuating their own power. So yeah, it's not enough to, you know, merely criticize and push back against the government. That's important. But I think also you need to strengthen the rights of individuals to act as a check against abuses of power, whether that's by the state or by another entity. So I'll give you an example, which is the Kaya Lum project of the Free Market Foundation. So as I mentioned, we are passionate about private property rights. And some of those critics that you mentioned, they might be quite glib about private property rights, like, oh, this is just the rich defending their ill-gotten gains and defending their privilege. But in actual fact, it is often the underprivileged in society, people who are most vulnerable, who need private property rights protections the most. Sometimes you might have people who are small traders, for example, running a spaza shop, and they get harassed by police and other officials, and they get forcibly removed. Or you might have an occasion where a widow she's been living in a home for decades, and her husband has recently passed away, and now suddenly her relatives want to eject her from her house because there's a dispute over the ownership of the property. So when we think of private property rights, what's the best instrument that you can use to defend your private property rights? Well, that's in many instances a title deed. And so what the Kaya Lum project of the Free Market Foundation has done is to identify poor disadvantaged people and to assist them with applying for title deeds for the homes that they live in. So it's a specific category of people who were former tenants of council-owned property. The councils have divested themselves of their ownership of these properties, and often the individuals or families who've been living in these homes have been doing so for generations, but they just don't have that very important legal document which proves their ownership status. Everyone in the community recognizes that they live there, but if ever they want to get a loan from the bank or there was some dispute over the property, they would not have the same recourse and legal protections as we enjoy sitting here in the suburbs. So the Kaya Lum project has been hugely successful. We've transferred at no cost to the beneficiaries since 2010, 16,000 title deeds, which I think is really a demonstration of us putting into practice our values, that private property rights are genuinely for everyone. And it's not merely some economic policy instrument. It's fundamental to who you are as a human being, to your rights as an individual. So I think making the case like that, but flipping it on its head, it's, you know, I think it's very important that wealthy people as generators of value and investors have protections, but it's also very important that poor people have these protections, because so often they are, in fact, more vulnerable to exploitation and to abuse by authorities. So really, you know, we're quite confident that these values transcend these different classes and different other kind of group interests in South Africa.
You're listening to 101.9 Chai FM. I'm Benji Shulman. This is the New Blue Review. And talking today to David Ansara, CEO of the Free Market Foundation. We'll be continuing this discussion coming up next on 101.9 Chai FM.
From Johannesburg to Jerusalem, the world is always changing, growing, and innovating. Join Benji Shulman for the next hour as he brings you the trendsetters, the thought leaders, and those creating news before it happens. Only on the New Blue Review, your favorite Jewish culture and current affairs show. Every Monday at 9 a.m. right here on 101.9 Chai FM.
101.9 Chai FM, Benji Shulman here on your Monday morning New Blue Review. We're talking today to David Ansara from the Free Market Foundation about their work in the economy and various individual rights aspects of South African society. Now, David, let's go abroad a little bit. Last week we had the election of Donald Trump. And I actually think that from a perspective of people that are interested in economy and free trade and that sort of thing, probably both candidates were potentially not a good outcome, but we have this particular one that has happened. And he's talking, or at least in the campaign trail, talking about 10% tariffs on certain kinds of cars and different products. And this is not something that we've really had that much discussion of, probably in the last decade. It's kind of come roaring back. So I thought it would be just interesting to have a discussion about tariffs. What are they? How might they affect us here in South Africa? And how would they affect people in the United States?
Yeah, so just I think my high-level view on Trump was that this represents a major shift in US politics and potentially for the globe. I think there's different lenses with which you can view his ascendancy. So I think even though he was president before, I think this time he's riding a wave of popular support, and I think it campaigned on quite an inclusive ticket, if you consider how many former Democrats like Robert Kennedy Jr. and Tulsi Gabbard, people like that, who actually were former Democrats who came over. I think it's a very significant moment. On the question of trade, I think that that is potentially a very negative development. I think what people like Donald Trump and his running mate JD Vance have identified is that, and this is correct, is that living standards, particularly for poor and working class Americans, have stagnated in the US. So I think their identification of the symptoms is correct, but I think that the diagnosis of the cause of that is incorrect. So Donald Trump looks at the US economy and he sees that a lot of big US corporates like Apple have headquartered their businesses abroad in tax efficient jurisdictions, and then also have located their manufacturing capabilities in places like China and other East Asian jurisdictions. And he sees that in a zero-sum way, that okay, these are jobs that are now could have been in America that have gone abroad, and we need to bring them back. And how do we bring them back? Or we make it more expensive for our competitors to sell into the US market. The US market is the biggest consumer market in the world. And Mr. Trump believes that that gives him bargaining power. And you've seen him use his political power to berate executives of these firms and say, well, why are you acting against the US interests and so on? You need to onshore some of these manufacturing capabilities. But I think the world has changed. And I think that what this represents is a tilt towards mercantilism, which I think has been proven time and time again to be an inefficient economic system. And this really goes back to the arguments of Adam Smith, that individuals and also by extension countries should rather focus on the specialization and their comparative advantage. This is also something that other economists have argued, like David Ricardo, for example, also a Scottish economist, that ultimately free trade is like a free lunch. Both parties benefit. And this enables you to take advantage of the specialization. It enables you to have global supply chains where you don't have to produce everything locally. I mean, if you think of the devices that you and I are conducting this interview on, this is a product of free trade. South Africa is an open economy. We buy electronic goods from abroad. We could, and wouldn't say never, but it would be very, very difficult for us to make these laptops and microphones and to develop the software that we use to do this. And we take these things for granted. And so I think it's ultimately the fallacy of this thinking is that if you impose tariffs, then China or your other competitors are effectively paying for that. But ultimately, it would be US consumers who are paying extra by being, those costs would be passed on to them. So I don't think that that is going to have the effect that Donald Trump and his team believe it will. Their argument is that they need to reduce income taxes for local firms to make it more competitive for them to invest locally, and that that would balance out, and that actually you'd have much more creation of domestic jobs, and then that would enable the government to meet its spending requirements. And the US deficit has been extraordinarily large, something like $6 trillion. And that's something that started during, well, started a long time ago, but really took off under Donald Trump's first administration and has continued under Biden as well. So none of the parties have really demonstrated a willingness to really tackle this huge deficit. But Mr. Trump believes that if you deregulate the economy and lower taxes, which I think are very important interventions, then it will offset the losses from imposing additional tariffs on competitors and on imports. But yeah, I think so. I would say tariffs bad, deregulation good, lower taxes good.
Yeah, it is very interesting. I mean, the stuff about the jobs is kind of interesting because the US does actually have quite a low unemployment. I mean, certainly compared to us, it's not even in the same hemisphere. But the issue is not so much even around the jobs that have gone, as it's that it's the jobs, it's what the jobs are paying, and how workers could potentially get more money. Really, for at the end of the month, which is it sounds to me more like the issue than the idea that jobs are moving abroad.
Yeah, I think I agree with you there, Benji. And not just that they're not getting paid enough, but that the cost of living is accelerating at a rapid pace. And the reason for that is because of the excessively loose monetary policy that has characterized the United States and other countries since the global financial crisis in 2008, 2009, where you've had so-called quantitative easing programs led by central banks. Which have enabled national treasuries to live well beyond their means and to run up these huge deficits because government, in order to finance its expenditure, has issued bonds, and then the central banks essentially purchase these assets. And so this monetization of the debt has fueled a lot of the inequality that we've seen in the world. And also the stagnation of living standards and the rising costs of living. And I don't have a fundamental problem with inequality if it is based on merit and on people offering more competitive goods and services in the market and people being shrewd investors and so on. But I think what's driven a lot of this inequality is the monetary policy, which has essentially almost pumped excess liquidity into equity markets, places where it can get yields, and that's really artificial. That's like a sugar high for the economy, and what the economy really needs is protein. And so, the reason people are experiencing this lower standard of living and the purchasing power of their dollars rapidly diminishing is because of decisions made by political elites and by economists and central banks in order to deal with short-term problems, whether that's the global financial crisis or the COVID crisis. But really the effect of that is being felt now. And I think the inflation story was a big driver of Donald Trump's victory. I think the Democrats campaigned a lot on social issues around things like abortion and transgender rights and things like that. But I think the US electorate was much more motivated and animated by bread and butter issues. And particularly low income people, I think, have really felt the effects of high inflation. The wealthy don't feel inflation as much because they also have assets that appreciate with inflation. And whereas poorer people are dependent on their income. And that has rapidly diminished in terms of its purchasing power. So I think that's really translated into this swing towards Trump at the polls.
Oh, absolutely fascinating. David, if people are interested in the work that you guys are doing, I know you send out a regular newsletter on different issues affecting the economy, the Kaya Lam project, all of this stuff you've been telling about, where can they find more information?
I think the best thing is to go to freemarketfoundation.com, and then you can also find us on social media. We're quite active on YouTube as well as Twitter and other platforms. And yeah, we've actually just done a relaunch of the Kaya Lam website. So if you'd like to check out the work that the Free Market Foundation is doing to strengthen private property rights in South Africa, you can go to kayalam.org.za. So that's kayalam.org.za. And yeah, please feel free to reach out to us. And if you like our work and you want to support us, we'd be hugely grateful for financial contributions as well to help us to amplify our message.
Amazing stuff. David and Sara from the Free Market Foundation, thanks so much for joining us on 101.9 High FM.
Thanks very much, Benji.